Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale. Coming up next on the Wet Fly Swing Podcast.
He started playing hide and seek, and I'm playing with them too. At this point, I'm just barely lobbing this Willie Nelson out there so it doesn't get snagged up. I mean, it's like half just rolling down the bottom of the river at this point. Spooks this stillhead out. Sees my fly just dang near bouncing along the bottom of the river. Freak comes in, annihilates it. And that was the first stillhead I got on the sea tuck. Is because of this otter.
That was Will Donnelly with the story about an otter helping him catch his first steelhead. This is our Ask a Pro series where you get firsthand advice and stories from guides we've been out fishing with. Welcome to the swing.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today.
If you get a chance, click that share button. If you have an episode you've listened to in the past you really enjoyed, and that's a great way. If you're brand new to the show, welcome, and check in anytime with me. If you have an idea for a show topic, I would love to put that together for you. Today's episode is sponsored by Fishhound Expeditions, putting together remote Alaskan wilderness trips for that trip of a lifetime. These are not your lodge style trips. These are not your car style trips. This is remote, floating in, flying in at times, floating in down Alaska in the middle of nowhere, mousing for rainbows, camping out under the stars of the Alaskan sky. This is good stuff. We did a trip earlier this year and it was amazing. You can check out these trips right now from Fishhound, wetflyswing.com/fishhound, F-I-S-H-H-O-U-N-D. Will Donnelly, head guide at Fishhound Expeditions, takes us into Alaska with a focus on road tripping. We break down Alaska by car, where you should be heading, which species you can chase, and some of the tips on flies, techniques for someone like Will, who lives in Alaska year-round. Pretty cool. We dig into a bunch of stories, including the trip we hooked up with last year. Alaska by road. Stay tuned in this one as Will describes his steelhead Astrovan and the mural that the rig is painted under. Here he is, Will Donnelly from fishhoundexpeditions.com. How's it going, Will?
Oh, pretty good. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks for making some time to come on here and talk a little bit of Alaska fishing. We got a pretty cool story because, I was up there with you on a guide trip up to the middle of nowhere in Alaska. I like to kind of think of it, which is kind of what we were, but we did this big trip up there and you were amazing. I mean, really from the first day, you know, that trip when we took a car drive down and stuff like that, right? It was just this whole experience. So I want to talk about all that and what you do in Alaska and your fishing background. But before we get into all that, take us back to fly fishing. How did you first come into fly fishing?
Oh, I first started fly fishing when I was in my young 20s, somewhere around 23. I fished my whole life. I didn't get into it until after my first back surgery. And my first back surgery was in the winter. And the only other river that's open in the winter up here is the Kenai most of the time in the winter. And I would just drive past the ski resort every day and go to the Kenai just to have something to do and stay sane. One of my buddies and his brother got me into fly fishing on their cataract on the Kenai River, and you know, I never looked back once I got a fly rod in my hand.
There you go. So the Kenai, so that's the big river, and so like this time of year or throughout the winter, that's the only thing, and people are still out there fishing throughout the winter.
Yeah, for the most part. You know, when I first started fly fishing the winter, like 10 plus years ago now, it was relatively empty, and you could you could find a lot of the river by yourself. But nowadays you go down there in the winter, it's like almost every good run and hole has more and more fly fishermen in there. So the Kenai is definitely where I got started. Super fun river, just a lot of people. And that's like the only thing that keeps me away from it now.
Gotcha. Gotcha. What is your, you were born in California, it sounds like, but you moved up to Alaska. Talk about that a little bit. How did you find yourself up in Alaska?
Oh, born in Redding, California. And then both the parents, you know, they both got paid more up here in Alaska, and they drug me and my sister and my brother.
Uh-huh.
And I lived in Alaska ever since like 10 years old.
Oh, wow. And where did you guys move up from Redding? Which city did you move into in Alaska?
Anchorage. So I was raised in Anchorage, South Side Anchorage. I'm just now starting to live in the Willow area, but lived in Anchorage ever since then.
That's right. So what is Anchorage like? I always think of Anchorage like you hear some of the jokes like, you know, Anchorage isn't really Alaska because it is the one place that, you know what I mean? But what is Anchorage? I mean, it is Alaska, obviously. I mean, talk about that. What is it like growing up for somebody who's never been up there or never lived up there? Why is Anchorage so cool? And then what is challenging about it?
Anchorage is our big city. Half the population lives in Anchorage. When you live in Anchorage and going to school in Anchorage, you're always calling like the cities or towns just north of you. You got your Wallsilla Billies or your Willow Billies, or everybody's like stupid inbred jokes and stuff like that. And then now that I'm on the other side living in the valley, you call them Anchorageites oh my gosh, I'm forgetting all the different terms, but there's always an animosity between everybody else in Anchorage. And then you even got like, so you got the valley, and that's just north of Anchorage, the two bigger communities up there. And then you got Anchorage, and then you got your outside villages and small towns area. So everybody has a different vibe on the way that they see each other, basically. But you definitely know when it's a weekend because everybody from Anchorage is going somewhere.
Oh, right. That's right. So everybody's heading out hunting or fishing. That's what I remember when we rolled in. We drove like 2 hours out towards Talkeetna. And I remember seeing on the road, it was just like everybody had a boat or there was a moose on the back. I mean, that's pretty much people are in Anchorage to hunt or fish or do something outdoors, right? That's whatever. Have you ever met like who up there? Do you meet many people that aren't into hunting and fishing?
So that's Anchorage. So it's a bigger city. And when I first moved up here, it was wild to me that like most of the kids my age didn't even know how to swim.
Oh, wow.
Or anything like that. And it was like, you know, Anchorage, you have, I would say a normal it's a high population of very outdoorsy people.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you're going to have a lot of your trail runners, hikers, cross-country skiers, snowboarders. And like
everything.
And, you know, for the most part, a lot of people find their niche to keep themselves sane outside.
Yeah.
But you also got people in Anchorage that are just like regular old. They rather just play video games.
Oh, right.
And go to the bar and that's it. You know, that
there you go.
You know, they might go on a hike every once in a while, play frisbee golf, but they're not outdoorsmen. You know, I'd say Anchorage has a higher population of outdoorsmen than a lot of other cities, but it's still you're gonna find, you know, your suits and ties and people that just don't go outside ever.
Wow. Yeah, that's cool. It's interesting. I'm reading a book on a tangent. It's pretty cool. My grandma's brother was a you know, if you go back in time in that, right? So we're talking the 30s when he was, you know, when he was a kid. But it was amazing because I'm hearing the stories from him, you know, this book, his son basically wrote this book about him and it's about the stories. And he was, you know, he was in Portland in the 30s and they decided just to be like, you know what, we're like, you know, they're foreclosing on the house. We're just going to take it up and leave and go down to the Rogue River and live on the Rogue. And they literally drove down and just lived on the Rogue River for like whatever. And they were gold panning and lived off of like gold. And it was funny because they're telling stories about how they had to protect their their area. But think of that. I mean, in that day and age, so basically 90 years ago, they were able to just drive down on the Rogue and just live there. Right. Like, no, I mean, and people are kind of doing that around here, too. It's a little different, the homeless and stuff. But I mean, you know what I mean? It's a different time. So like in Alaska feels like to me, it's still that you still have that thing where you can. I mean, it's different, obviously. But do you still feel that out there where people are there because they're like, you know what? We're doing our own thing and we're not going to have anybody really tell us what we do up here. Is that kind of what's cool? One of the cool things about it?
Yeah, totally. You'll not necessarily in Anchorage, but you're going to find that in the smaller communities. And then you really find that in the really out of the way communities that you need to take a four wheeler for hours or a helicopter, bush plane or a boat to.
Yep.
You find a lot more of those independent, just trying to disappear or do their own thing by themselves. But in Anchorage, you don't really see a lot of that. You know,
yeah. That's a city.
That was one of the cool things about growing up in Anchorage. It's the second most diverse school district in the nation to New York.
And amazing.
A lot of different communities that move up here, like your Samoans or Hawaiians and a lot of the other Asian communities, all of them. Mm-hmm. Then you also get some like refugees from Africa and stuff that show up. And You just get it's a giant melting pot in Anchorage.
Yeah, I guess because probably I'm guessing there's opportunity, right? There's jobs up there, and it must be a place where anybody can probably go and find work up there, right? It might not be the easiest work.
Yeah, you definitely get paid more on average in Alaska, but it does cost a lot to live up here. And I think one thing that people look for is the permanent fund dividend or the PFD. And when you have a big family with like 5+ kids, and like this year it was $3,000, that's a lot of money.
Oh, wow. So you get 3,000 per kid. So if you had 5 kids, you're getting like whatever, 18K or 20 or something like that.
Yep. Growing up, you have a lot of parents that will put it away in an investment or a college thing. And then you got other parents that just have to use it for bills and stuff.
Right. That's interesting. Okay. So that's a little flavor of kind of the people up there and the community thing. And then what about the weather? So that's always the next thing. Is it, you know, like right now it's, you know, and there's other places that are cold, but what's your take on it? Like throughout the winter, is it something you kind of get used to once you've lived up there enough?
You definitely get used to it. I started to go a little crazy. When I hurt my back, I wasn't snowboarding every day during the winter like I used to. So you need to figure out something to do because it's long, dark, and cold.
Yeah.
And if you're not being active and stuff, it's pretty easy to not want to be here. For the last few years, I just been traveling the West Coast, basically Hawaii, Washington to Mexico, the last few years during the winter, finding
nice
spots to surf and fish.
Right on.
And hanging out with family and friends. But right now, finally getting above zero, it's at a whole 2 degrees, and it feels really nice compared to the negative 35 for the last 2 weeks almost. And we got 5 feet of snow right before that in just two to three days.
Oh, wow.
When I came back from Honduras, I had to dig out cars that you couldn't even see anymore.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
I was like, I don't want to be here right now.
That's right. The Honduras. So let's go. We're going to dig into some Alaska, some tips on doing a road trip to Alaska sort of thing. But let's go back. I want to hear that Honduras because Cam, another guy who was on the trip that we did, you know, is down there, right? So you met up with Cam. What was that like down there? Because sounds like a pretty cool operation.
Oh, man. The spot that we're at, one of the Bay Islands there in Honduras, it was one of the coolest things I'd done in a long time. In a vacation towards the end of it, you're ready to go home. I was dreading it. I went down there to just fish. That's what I thought.
Yeah.
But then the first day I went fishing with Cam on the flat, and my first shot, this is going to sound crazy, but I caught a bone on one of my very first casts, my first shots. And I was just listening to Cam. I didn't see the bones necessarily. And he's all talking about don't cast directly on top of them. Yep. You're going to cast short or wide, whatever it is. And I'm basically just, I casted it out there and I'm just staring at Cam. I'm like, okay, now what? And I'm stripping in. I could feel some grass and I felt something that felt like grass, but maybe a little bit different. I set that hook, a nice strip set. And that thing took me in my backing before I even knew it. It was one of the, apparently I like blacked out a little bit when I had that fish on.
Oh, really? too much to drink that afternoon.
it was in the early morning.
Okay. Could have been still.
No alcohol involved at all. And I guess I like ran over and hugged him when I had the fish on. I don't remember this at all, but I caught that bone. Hit another bone, a smaller bone. Yeah. That was a medium. The first bone I caught was a medium bone, and then the second bone was a little guy. And then I went 2 days on a flatboat after that, and the conditions are tough. It was rainy. The water was a little murky. And we fished hard. We got into some cool little bays that we had to time the waves to get in there. And I mean, it was just beautiful. Had maybe two chances at one permit in a little school of bone. Nothing happened. And after that, you got diving down there, and I started diving, and that's what I spent most of my time doing, diving.
Oh, wow. Yeah. No kidding. Just like free diving, just with the whatever.
Scuba diving.
Oh, scuba. The full deal.
Yeah. I just got scuba open water certified and advanced. And when I go back next year, I might work on my master's.
Wow. So now talk about that just for a second here. Like the scuba, that sounds pretty cool. Was that, what was that like down there? Scuba? Did you just go down and just hanging out with the fish? And
Like whenever I go to Hawaii, Mexico and stuff, I'll snorkel and do a little bit of spear fishing just with the snorkel. But now like with the scuba set, you could stay down there. It is just wild, especially the night dive we took where you just have a flashlight. Seeing octopus, you're seeing big lobster. It was just super, super cool. Like when I went down there with one of our other guides too, Shane, and Adam was down there too at the same time. And I kind of felt bad. I never really fished with Adam because we're just on two different schedules. He's always fishing and I have to do these scuba courses. And me and Shane, we were like, man, we got all summer to fish. That's what we do.
Yeah, right.
That's like one of the first times in my life where I chose something else other than fly fishing.
There you go. That makes sense to me because, you're in the place. You've got the scuba. You got the skills. Yeah, that sounds like a pretty cool alternative. That's amazing. And then Adam, of course, is with Fishhound Expeditions, who he's kind of leading the show out there. And he's the person that's been hooking everything up with us and the trip and everything. So we've done a few episodes, some stuff with Adam already. I'll have links in the show notes to those. They can check it out. But this is good. I think we'll circle back around maybe if we have time at the end to hear some more of your scuba, some of the stuff there. But let's get into this this trip. So this Alaska thing and think about the person who is, maybe flying into Anchorage, getting a rental car, and they're just going for it. Or maybe they're even driving up the Alaska Highway and they're doing a full thing they're going to be up there for, a month or something like that. What do you tell somebody if they're like, because there's a lot of water up there, there's a lot going on, as far as doing it from the road, is that a doable thing? And then what do they need to think about?
Yes. I 1,000% recommending renting a car or whatever vehicle, borrowing a vehicle from a family member, whatever it is. And it totally depends on the time of year on what you would be doing and what you're looking for. So salmon and trout, when people come to Alaska, they think they could just catch a king any time of the year.
Right.
It doesn't work that way. Like kings show up first, then it's like sockeye and pinks, chum and silver. That's kind of the order that they come in, but it just depends on what you're looking for. If you're just a trout bum, you have to go try the Kenai a little bit, and it depends on the time of year you're on. The Kenai is a super famous legit river. It's just really popular and a lot of people, and the fishing can be tough because of that, but you find it on certain times of the year. Like when I first started fly fishing the Kenai, my family they still go down to the confluence of the Russian River and they snag their limit of reds. But I got to the point where I would just hang out by the fly fishing cleaning stations with my fly rod with like a six pack waiting for someone to throw their guts in. And you're catching a freaking seagull or a rainbow every cast when you do that.
Oh, wow. That's funny. No kidding.
I can't tell you how many seagulls I wrestled in front of those 1,000 tourists, you know, as a younger dude.
Oh, wow. So that's the Kenai. Yeah. And I've been down there quite a long time ago. It's a huge area, lots of tribs, things like that. What are the other areas? If you think about driving, you know, if you're going to do, I guess you can think of it as like, I'm going to do a day trip from Anchorage, or I'm going to go a little bit further. Are there some other areas like north, you know,
If it was me, I would drive north to the Susitna Valley and explore all those tributaries. And you got everything from rainbows to dollies or dolly varden to Arctic grayling. And, you know, again, depending on that time of year, it changes on how you're fishing. In the very beginning of the year, the very, very beginning during ice out, you're going to be using like dead eggs. And then it quickly goes to the outgoing smolt migration or fry migration. So you're going to be imitating those things like a woolly bugger or whatever, stuff like that. And then you're going to switch to your bigger streamers. And then again, finally, once those salmon start dropping eggs, and you're going to go to an egg pattern. And the way these tributaries work along the Susitna, you know, as it goes later on in the year after ice out, those fish spread out, because these fish on the Sioux, they're all connected to the Susitna River, and you got all these tributaries, and they don't live in the tributaries year round. They live in the Big Sioux when it's all frozen over, because these rivers are just a trickle underneath feet of ice. So they're not living in the little tributaries. So as the year goes, they go up the tributaries, and as the water drops and starts to freeze, they go back into the Sioux. So depending on the time of year is depending on where you're going to fish along those tributaries. The higher up you get on these tributaries, you're going to find more Arctic grayling. And some of the Arctic grayling fishing out here is just ridiculously good, where you could pick any dry fly and that most likely they'll hit it a few times until they don't and switch it back up. And it's pretty fun. And some beautiful out of the way spots on some of these tributaries. If you find one of the fishing trails and just hike up, get into like a little canyony area and just go from pool to pool, and there's big rainbows in there too. Don't like, you might catch a nice 20 plus inch rainbow on a little dry fly up here. And, you know, for the most part in Alaska, unless we're grayling fishing, I avoid the little dry flies, because it's just, these fish up here are meat eaters. They like, my favorite dry fly, I don't think you count it as a dry fly, but it's a mouse.
Yeah, it's the mouse. Yeah, that's right. How does the mouse thing? Talk about that a little bit. When is the mousing, you know, when does that kind of get good?
Ooh, as soon as they start to trickle their ways up the tributaries, you're going to want clearer water for sure, so they can see it. Like when me and you went fishing on that heli trip, I was really disappointed. Like we had to work hard a little bit until that water dropped and cleared up for us. And, you know, usually that time of year when we went, they're not looking up as much as they are looking down for those eggs. Because it's just such an easy meal. But when the water is low and clear, you're running a mouse over those runs. You're still going to get some trout on the mice all the way until the end of the year.
Amazing.
Like the last trip I took on that river before me and you went, the water was clear enough. And we caught a nice like 24 inch leopard bow before I even had the boat set up. And
on a mouse,
yes sir.
There you go.
Yeah, that's my most favorite way to catch a rainbow, is on a mouse. Hands down.
Yep, that's it. And that's what it was. Yeah, we had a this last year, yeah, super rainy. It was super flooding and the water was just high. We got in there. But in a normal year, you might have lower flows, clear water. And even into September, you could still get fish on the mousing stuff, even though earlier is good too, because like after ice out, fish are super hungry. So they're chowing, but probably the period where the mousing isn't as good is when it's like full on eggs everywhere. Is that kind of how it works?
Yeah. So those fish are going to be holding up in different runs depending on what fish is spawning when, and when the river is literally choked with eggs, they're really just being fat and lethargic, and they have no reason to go up because they could barely fit another egg in their belly.
Right.
There's sometimes a week to 2 week period in August. We call it the glut. And it's when all these pink salmon are spawning so heavily that if you don't have that perfect bead color, perfect bead size with the perfect drift, and just pray that this fish decides to eat your egg, because they're so full. When you do catch one of them, they're puking dozens of eggs as you're unhooking them. And it is just, it can be really frustrating because you see hundreds and hundreds of fish and that you got a guy that's trying to catch a trout. And I'm like,
damn,
I'm sorry. They're too full,
Right. They're literally choking. Probably like eggs are probably like spurting out of their mouth. They're so fat and
choking with eggs. And sometimes in the beginning of the year, when you're catching the trout with the outgoing fry migration, you'll see them puke literally dozens of baby salmon.
Jeez.
Just dozens and dozens of baby salmon. And you know, it's that time of year when if you're floating down a river, or if you're in one of the confluences and you see Arctic terns or seagulls, typically the Arctic terns are the ones that are dive bombing. You know, they're looking for those baby fish. And if you're watching where that happens and you see a splash not created by a bird, that's a fish. And the thing that a lot of people do, they just want to go to a big, heavy sculpin pattern. And yeah, that might work, it's not going to work as well. You want a lighter pattern that's going to skim right under the surface, because that's where, if you're watching these little baby salmon go out to the ocean, that's where they're at. They're right on the surface. And if you're floating down a river and you see a log jam and you see birds on the log jam poking at the water, they're eating the baby salmon.
You want to,
wood is good. You want to be near that wood.
Wood is good. So are you with the streamers now? We're kind of in the streamer game. Is it? So you're saying basically you're fishing, like, how are you? Let's just describe that. How are you fishing the streamers up there?
Oh, I want it down and across to the downhang. Like, not a lot of, so you get these guys that know what they're doing from the States, like especially Colorado.
Yep.
They want to slap that bank and like aggressively bring it back in and stuff. I want to throw it slightly down at the deep outside bank, typically right in front of a log jam. That's my favorite. And then you give it an upriver mend and you let it pull tight and you just let it swing, especially if you're fishing a Dalai Lama or something. And a Dalai Lama represents a lamprey, and lampreys are a big food source for a lot of these trout. It's a 4-inch wet sock, basically, of rabbit fur with a cone head that you lob out there. And you just let it do its thing. You get it tight to get it right so you can feel the bite.
Yep.
And that's it. You know, you don't need to, you know, if you're doing too much, you're just spooking these trout.
Yeah, you're spooking them. Wow. So are you using what's the line? Is this just a dry line, or are you actually using some sort of intermediate sinking line?
Oh, my favorite is Rio outbound short with I don't know, 6-foot leader. Yeah, somewhere around there. So it's more manageable, so people could actually feel the bite and stuff. And, but the way I like to do it, especially if we're on the boat, I'm going to back row my butt off right in front of log jams and stuff, so we don't kill ourselves, but also pull that big old trout out of the wood.
Right. Right. So you guys are fishing those Dalai Lamas from the boat too and off the bank.
Oh yeah. So now that we're talking about Dalai Lama now, if you have a buddy has a mouse, and you have the Dalai Lama, the rule is the mouse always goes first before the Dalai Lama, because that Dalai Lama will typically clean it up. So that's like more, you know, right before bead drop, like, you know, in June. The first bead drop or egg drop happens in like July when the kings first start dropping their eggs. So all the way before some point in July, you're going to be using your streamers, Dalai Lamas, woolly buggers, stuff like that.
Okay. So that's it. So streamers, so you got the mice you're doing early, and then the streamers are working there. Well, and are the Dalai Lamas, is that working throughout? When does the Dalai Lama not work throughout the summer?
Stop using Dalai Lamas, especially in August, because these fish, for the most part, getting picked on all year long by Dalai Lamas. And then they got an easier food source of, with all those pink salmon spawning, the eggs. So
eggs take over.
It's just eggs. And you might switch it up a little bit. You could have an egg pattern. And, you know, in Alaska, we peg beads. So you have like inch and a half, 2 inches from your hook to the bead. And sometimes you can experiment, especially during the glut, experiment with something else on the bottom of the bead, like some kind of bug, maybe a sandworm.
Sure.
That's some of my favorite. I don't even like saying that really, because that stuff makes all the difference on some of those days.
Gotcha. Especially probably those days where people are, maybe the fish are seeing, there's a lot of anglers, something a little different.
Yeah. A little bit different, or water clarities too sometimes. Mm. So you could do the whole steak and egg pattern where you have, what that is an egg with a flesh fly. And a flesh fly here in Alaska is, you know, representing a dead piece of salmon floating down the river. Mm-hmm. And that's what these fish live on during the winter, is freezer burnt salmon breaking up out of the gravel or the ice. And as it floats down, they'll eat the eggs or the carcasses.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's it. So it reminds me again. So the steak and eggs is what is that set up now?
So you could have a fly with a built-in steak and egg pattern, you know, where it's just an egg and a flesh, or you could get just a flesh fly in variety of sizes, from micro to popcorn size to a bigger chunk of rabbit fur of some sort. And I like doing that when the water is a little bit murkier, so it has a better profile and just something for these fish to maybe see. And this last winter, or last summer, our weather went from pure sunshine from March all the way to the end of July. And then after the end of July, we had, what, 3 or 4 different flood events.
God, wow. It all came in one event, or one summer, late summer.
Yeah, from the end of July to throughout September was nothing but flood events.
Yeah,
one after another. And the rivers, like, so Willow Creek, that I do my day guiding on, where me and you first fish.
Yep.
We, the average flow is somewhere around 500 CFS, that's cubic feet per second.
Yep.
And we were up into the 6,000 to 8,000s, I think, this year. Wow. It's the highest I ever seen it.
Right. So it's flood. Was that campground? Was that where we put in? Was that flooded, that parking lot?
Oh yeah. We basically had to put in there at that one RV spot. That's where we had to put in.
And you're still able at the high flows. So you're still able to fish it even at those high flows.
Oof. So yeah. Well, okay. If it's during salmon season, I know a couple little spots where there's clear water that runs out of the marshes, and it's relatively clear, that flow in. And high, the whole creek, the woods are all flooded too. There's nowhere to get out to take a piss or do the barbecue. I had to set up the barbecue on the boat box one day. But in those two spots where all the salmon hang out, and thank God they're cool about not catching trout, because there was no way in hell we were catching a trout that day, those days. No. But those salmon, they all hang out, and I can't even tell you how many salmon we caught.
Oh, really?
I don't know what I sound like saying this, but it was like the most boring fishing trip ever, sitting in two holes, just unhooking salmon after salmon after salmon.
What were the salmon? What species were they?
Pinks, chum,
pinks.
And silver. The silvers are just showing up. So we only caught a couple of them in that beginning of that first flood during that time. But then as the season goes on, the pink salmon start to die off and there's just more silvers. We started calling them silvers, fish of 1,000 pinks.
you had to catch
1,000 pinks just to catch one silver.
That's right. Yeah, the pinks. And the pinks is unique because the pinks, you know, that is one species that are abundant up there. But as you go down south, you don't find as many pinks. You know, it's more of a northern thing. So basically you got that. Yeah, you had a crazy year up here this year. I guess if you take it to like a normal year, and let's just think of that. So, and we'll go back to the person driving up there. So they hop in their rental car in Anchorage. They get off the plane. They're like, okay, we got a week. We're going to travel up and just hit some fishing. They got their gear in, and then they head up to, let's say, towards, like you're saying, up there to the Susitna Valley, and there's tons of streams. And you could just pretty much go up there and find any stream, park in a lot, and just start hiking. And is that pretty much the thing to do? I mean, I would say before you get there is that hiring a guide for a day is a really good thing to do always, right, to get the lay of the land?
For sure. So I get that a lot. You know, especially like when I used to drive my Astro van that's painted like a steelhead. You get people.
Wait. Do you still have this Astro van?
I do. I'm just not driving it right now.
Oh man! Now we got it. You got to send me a picture. Could you send me a picture of that? And I'll put it in the show notes.
I will. It's just that's an old amazing Astro van.
Oh yeah, I love that. Well, the thing about the Astro van as well is that my buddy in high school, his parents had Astro van, and this is the type of guy he was. He would go out there. We would go driving around town, like to Taco Bell or whatever, and he'd be like, "Check this out. It's got posi, whatever, right? So you could like spin both tires at the same time." So he would put the foot on the brake and then just gas it, and he'd just burn rubber all over town. Like, could your van do that?
No. Mine was all wheel drive. Thank God.
Oh. Gotcha. Okay.
I call it the bad Astro because that thing went everywhere I wanted to take it. I love that van. You know, I wish that's I awesome. Had it up here right now because my SUV right now, the freaking won't engage into four-wheel drive.
Oh, shoot.
And so that's a hassle. I'm trying to find a shop to get it into soon.
Sure.
Yes, when I had that Astro van painted like a trout, there's Gandalf on the back. That was the first time I ever spray painted in my life too, by the way, first and only. So
you paint it. So you literally paint this van with a rattle can yourself.
Oh yeah. The reason I did that, I was, after I had I had those three back surgeries, blah, blah, blah. And when I was finally done with all that physical therapy and stuff, I was like, and it's starting to become, it's springtime. I was trying to figure out what am I going to do with my summer. And I just looked up Yakutat, Alaska and the ferry system. And I brought my ferry, you know, I was going to bring the van down on the ferry and live in Yakutat for a year. And it was just this old, it's like a 98 Astro van, brown.
Yeah.
So I was like, screw it. I just, you know, got some moose tooth pizza and invited two of the girls that I knew that were in college for art, even though they never spray painted either. And we worked on the van and it turned out all right. You know, it's a steelhead and then the one girl's like, can I put Gandalf on the back? I'm like, sure. So there's a giant stencil of Gandalf on the back and it says, you shall not pass on my van. And when I brought it down to Yakutat, I was just trying to catch some of my first southeast steelhead and surfed. That's Surf City, Alaska.
Wow. No kidding. Oh, so they're surfing down there.
Yeah, they have a surf shop. I think it's the most farthest north surf shop in North America.
Crazy. There you go. So did you end up hooking any of those steelhead?
Yes. That's right. And if you know the river, the Setuck in Yakutat, especially there near the upper end on 9 Mile, it's a small creek. And that's right when I got my first two-handed rod. So I was just forcing the issue with that thing and fishing a 13-foot rod in little spots. And I happened to hook a giant. Okay. I got to tell the story. So yeah, my first steelhead, I'm camping at 9 Mile. And I seen a new group of steelhead come in and I'm fishing this one steelhead, giving it perfect swings with the Willie Nelson. It's basically like a fancy egg sucking leech. Mm-hmm. And I'm giving it just perfect drifts. And then an otter comes out on the other. And this steelhead wants nothing to do with it. It looks like he's just sleeping, just holding there. And this otter comes out on the other side of the river and he starts to go down. And I start going like making chirpy noises and stuff to him. And like he started playing hide and seek and I'm playing with them too.
All right.
And then he runs up river, right? And then dives into that hole. And at this point, I'm just barely lobbing this Willie Nelson out there so it doesn't get snagged up. I mean, it's like half just rolling down the bottom of the river at this point. Spooks this steelhead out, sees my fly just dang near bouncing along the bottom of the river, comes in, annihilates it.
No way.
And then somehow I was able to set the hook, and that was the first steelhead I got on the sea tuck.
Wow.
Just because of this otter.
On the Willie Nelson.
On the Willie Nelson. It was a battle too. I had to like jump in the river, cross it, land in the next hole down. And it is probably one of the biggest steelhead I caught. I measured a few at 36 inches and this buck dwarfed it. I didn't measure it.
Really?
I don't want to put no claims out there, but.
So this is a giant, feel like a 20 pound fish or something.
It did not feel real. It still doesn't to me. I wish I had the picture of it. But I don't.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's a better story without the photo, I think.
Oh, God. I still have dreams thinking about, like, I wish I could just see that fish again.
How'd you release it? So you get this fish in. Did you actually touch it?
Yeah, I tailed it, unhooked it.
Yeah.
Let it catch its breath, admired it, let it go.
Let it go. Boom. Wow. I know. The Yakutat is a place I haven't been to, but I know it's one of those places. It's another one of those bucket list places to get up to. I mean, Alaska has so many of those places, you know. I mean, we're talking about doing a trip up to like further north this next summer, like doing like a DIY trip where we're just going to like go into the middle of nowhere, like, you know, sort of thing. But there's all these places, right? You got, and we're talking about more Anchorage, like driving from Anchorage. And there's lots of, when you do the drive out, it probably feels like, can you still get away from the crowds and get on a place within driving distance? You can.
So like if you're going to drive in Anchorage, and you want to find a place to fish, like it totally depends on the time of year.
Today's episode is sponsored by Fishhound Expeditions, who puts together remote Alaskan wilderness trips for that bucket list trip of a lifetime. And these aren't your typical lodge style trips or DIYing it. This is basically floating down the river in remote Alaska with the rainbows, the bears, and all the critters out there. But getting the luxurious comforts of camping with tents and cots and good food and all that stuff. We've had Adam on in a number of episodes here and actually just give away a big trip this year up to Alaska. So he's been doing some good stuff. Adam and the crew have done a great job. We were on a trip with them down on this remote section. We had the Northern Lights one night. We had beautiful floating down the river. We had whitewater, good food, big campfires, you name it. Got some nice big rainbows, got some coho. It was just an epic all-around trip, and it definitely was a trip of a lifetime. You can head over right now if you want to check this out, wetflyswing.com/fishhound, and check in with Adam and pick his brain to see what kind of trips they have on the list. I know they're filling up quick, so if you want to get in there for this next year, check out Fishhound, FISHHOUNT, to connect with Adam and the crew over at the Fishhound. And you support this podcast by clicking through that link and checking in with the crew. Okay, back to the show.
Let's take it for that, Will. Let's just say like this. Somebody's coming up, just say July. Let's just say they want to hit Chinook and they want to try to hit Chinook. I know runs are down a little bit in some areas, but if they wanted to hit Chinook and some other stuff, what would you recommend? You know what I mean? What would be the thought there? That might be a challenge because it is Chinook.
So the fisheries along the road system here around north or south of Anchorage typically start Memorial Day. So, and that's sometimes, you know, depending on the runs, like how early or late they are, you could go down to the peninsula, the Kenai Peninsula, that's south of Anchorage, and you could fish almost all of those streams from Homer to the Kenai for your kings.
Oh, you could. Okay, so any trib, you can go in and fish any tributary or the Kenai itself, but there's tribs that you could fish for kings.
Not tributaries to the Kenai. So you've got the Kenai River. So when you're driving south, the first river that you're going to want to fish is the Kenai. And then after that, you got the Kasih Lough. And then after that, you got Nanilchik, Deep Creek, Anchor. You got all those smaller rivers. They're basically creeks. And okay. you could fish those. But like there on Memorial Day, since it's the opener that starts at 12 o'clock at night, it's going to be a little crowded as the season goes on. And if the law allows you to do that. And okay, one thing I got to tell people, everybody too, every year they have an EO or an emergency order. So when you go get your booklet from a Walmart or something or the gas station, the fishing regs, they'll say, you're allowed to fish so-and-so days and use bait and gear or trebed hooks and stuff like that. But for the last, like, longest time I can remember, they have an emergency order that comes out every year saying it has to be single hook, artificial only, no bait. So that will get a lot of people coming up here. They're like, well, I'm going by the book. It's like, no, you got to always look up your emergency orders.
Gotcha. That's a good tip. That's a good reminder. Okay.
Especially for those kings, you know. Now, if you're trying to catch kings, now towards July, you might want to come up north and the tributaries on the roadside. So the east side tributaries to the Susitna that's connected to Highway 3 here, you want to go to those confluence and you're going to want to try to swing them up that way.
Oh, at the confluence. So like fish the Susitna just at the confluence or in the confluence of the tribs.
Yeah. That's your best bet. And they're only, you know, and again, it's totally dependent on the EOs.
Yeah. Like what's open and what you can do.
Yeah. So it changes all the time. They do helicopter surveys.
Oh, wow.
And stuff. And they just try to get an idea of the king salmon count. And along the west side of the Sioux on the Deshka, they have a weir, and the weir will, you know, tell fishing game how much fishing anybody could do. And there on the Deshka used to be a giant industry of guides taking people to king salmon fish, and a local thing where a lot of locals will take their jet boat and go fish that confluence and a little bit up from the confluence for your kings. But now it's just, it's so poor. It's just not a thing runs are down. Anymore. Yeah.
Runs are down. That's the thing. We're heading up north to like up out of the Barren, like Bethel, right? We're heading way up north. So I think the runs up there, even though I think there's some ups and downs there, I think the runs probably are larger.
You know, Bethel is like the same, what do you call it? Latitude or longitude? Latitude. As Anchorage.
Oh, it is. Oh, wow. It is. Oh, that's amazing. I didn't realize that. I always think of that being way up north, but it's not. Okay.
Because a lot of the times, if you look at our maps, Alaska's kind of twisted up because as you get closer to the poles on a globe, it doesn't line
that,
up.
That's
right?
That's a cool reminder. I never thought of that.
But yes, Bethel.
That's awesome.
You know, out of some of those, you know, I can't even tell you how many different streams are along the Kuskokwim and other rivers like the river south.
We're going to the Kinnektok. We're going to be like dropping in the Kinnektok. Yeah.
Heck yeah. Definitely mouse on your way till you find those kings.
That's what we're doing. I'm going to have a box of mice patterns and I'm going to have a box of king patterns. And then obviously everything else will work. You know what I mean? But my whole thing is like, dude, I would love to get some rainbows on the mice. I would love to get a king on, you know, just swing some kings up. That's kind of what we're going for.
Heck yeah. My favorite mouse pattern is that Rio pipsqueak.
Oh, okay.
It has little pink ears on the top and you could see it real well. Yeah. Swims good. That articulating hook seems to get more hookups. You know, a lot of the times, you know, when you're mousing, you know, don't set that hook right away. Do not set it. You let them turn with it a little bit.
Oh, really?
Like if you're topwater bass fishing, I'll tell the bass fisherman that. Like give it a second and don't set the hook super aggressive, you know. This is a cheater way. Like I always find that it's almost 100% hookups, but this is not fly fishing. Like if you're in some of those braided rivers out west, and you're walking it or whatever, and you find this one braid and it's just choked with trees, or you just don't feel like walking down it. This one time you just cast out there pretty far across and you just strip out all your line. You just strip it all out and you let it just hang straight down river and slowly reel it in. And you got that wake and you'll see fish coming in on both sides, just going to come and annihilate your fly. I think the total wakes I saw on one was like six fish for trying to beat.
Just from reeling up.
Well, you could do it stripping too and call yourself fly fishing. But But when you're reeling and your rod's low, your line's straight and tight, they grab it. And when they turn, they just hook themselves.
Yeah, they hook themselves. Exactly. You don't have to set the hook downstream, right? And make the good hook set. They'll do it for themselves.
Yeah. And a lot of the times you're with a mouse to fish it right, you always just want to wait. You got a lot of people that want to sit there and hold that rod up and jig, 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 jig. But if you have a bunch of line out there, that ain't doing nothing to your mouse. You're just jigging that rod for no reason. All I care about is a nice wake on that mouse. You know, make it.
Oh,
and you know what? Sometimes it doesn't even matter. There's this one guy, he's like, I'm getting more bites on just a dead drift of mouse. So I'm like, whatever blows your skirt up, man. But if you're if I'm fishing, I'm actively fishing it, you know.
Right. That's fine.
You catch it any way you want. I don't care.
Yeah, I hear you. No, that's awesome. Well, and so back to the Kings there, on the Kings, is do you guys actually guide for, is that something where people are like, hey, I want to go out and take a day trip for some Kings? Do you guys do that, like with Fish Town and what you do?
Yes, we do that. It's a little bit more rare lately because the laws are so finicky.
Yeah, because they've been tough.
You know, it's hard to have somebody going to fly up and, you know, hopefully, you know, when they're here, it's legal and that there's fish here, because who knows that the fish are going to be a couple weeks late, a couple weeks early. And king fishing's just tough.
It is tough, right? It's not the easiest thing. That's the thing. It's not like coho fishing, right? It's a totally different deal.
Yes, you're not going to find them all eddied out in a, you know, chilling in an eddy where you could use top water for a silver. No, these guys are hanging out deeper, typically a little bit faster water than the rest of the salmon, especially when they spawn.
I'd imagine the thing to do would be to, like, I think about this, if I was going to do a trip, you know, even like take the family up, right? You got the family, you're doing this road trip. It'd be fun to do the whole Alaska Highway, right? Do a thing and then get up there and you have like a month or maybe two or maybe the whole summer where you're like, you know what, we're just going to camp out and travel Alaska. Then, you know, it gives you a little more opportunity to be like, well, if we hit the Kings, great. If not, then we'll hit whatever else is coming up, right? I mean, I guess the more time you have up there, probably the better, right?
Oh, man, some of my favorite time to fish up here is June. In beginning of July until the eggs drop, because they're just so aggressive hitting, you know, your streamers and your mice. Yes.
Yeah.
And then the weather is typically the nicest in July.
It is. Right. Longest days of the year.
June 21st, longest day of the year for sure. Like yesterday was just our shortest day of the year here. You could fish like so in Alaska, like during when the Kings are in, you could fit, or at least on the Sioux, you're allowed to fish from 6 to 11 or 6 to 10, but you have light all the way to 11 o'clock fishing weather. And, you know, in Alaska, you know, we start our day trips at 10 o'clock, and a lot of people, they go, well, shouldn't we be waking up early? I'm like, nope, the fish are still going to bite. And if anything, during that time of year, you want that water to warm up a little bit more, especially that early season stuff, like early June and before June there. You as the day goes on, you know, what the water temp is at the highest almost right before the sun starts to go down. And you could feel the fishing get better sometimes as that water warms up, because in the beginning of the year, you have like 10 degree water temp changes every day. It's pretty wild.
Damn.
And so, you know, like temperature and fish is, you know, a big deal, you know, like, so you want to hit that wheelhouse of 50 degrees, or I get excited once it breaks 40, you know, I'm getting excited early season. I'm like, oh, it's on. And you're always looking for consistency. Like consistency in temperature is a big thing. Like when you get later on in the year and you get these rain events and stuff and it just drops and it stays dropped, that temperature, it's hard to get decent amount of bites. you know, but if it's a consistent drop and these fish feel winter coming and they need to put on that fat, it's good. It's just when it's drastic changes up and down, it makes it tough.
Yeah, that's it. Okay. And I was thinking earlier just about the guiding, right? So you guys, I mean, obviously you're guiding throughout, you know, the year with Fish Hound expeditions. What is it if somebody's up there? And I think it is a good advice. You hear this a lot, right? You're going up to a new area. It, you know, if somebody's coming up there, it'd be a good idea to at least get a guide for a day because they could show you at least one river. You can kind of learn the land, right? What would be your tips for somebody that wants to make a successful trip with a guide? Because I'm sure up in Alaska, you guys see all sorts of people that don't know anything to, like, what would you tell somebody if they're new to fishing Alaska, they're going to hire you guys for a trip? What do you tell them? Like, these are the things you should be doing to get ready to make this a successful trip.
So, you know, I had that happen to me quite a few times, almost a couple times a year, where you get a young dude or a young couple, they're like living out of a van or something for a month or two, and they're just trying to figure stuff out. And, you know, Alaska fishing is different. Like when I go down to the States, I need to figure it out. Like when I go to Oregon near Bend with my sister, it took me a while to figure out these fish. Like I'm not used to using a blue wing olive.
Right.
Like no freaking way catching fish on this little thing. I'm a spoiled Alaskan where I'm using 8-pound Nasma as my tippet, you know, and then I have to go down and use 5X. It's all different. But like when you get these people up in their van and they're trying to figure it out, like when I had my van, they would stop and ask me what's going on, where should I go? And I'll give them, you know, I'll be like, okay, this time of year, you want to be here using this kind of stuff. Yeah. And I'm pretty friendly with those people. Like I don't give up all my secrets and all my secret trails, you know, to get into some really good out of the way spots, but I'm definitely going to set you up for success. You know, like in this one young gentleman, he's a fighter jet in school for being a fighter jet pilot. And he came up and he's borrowed a van from the family and he's trying to figure stuff out. And we went on a guided trip on Willow where me and you first went, and we had an excellent day. And he came back to hang out with us that night. We're just drinking around a campfire. And then, you know, he was convinced to do that heli trip too. And we had one of the best days. You know, the river was perfect. All the conditions are perfect. A lot of salmon, a lot of big trout. It was in sight fishing some of those little side tributaries that come in on the helicopter trip. And it was just, it was wild where you're like crawling through bush and you just give like little bow and arrow or a flip cast and these little tiny runs catching 2-foot trout. It was super fun. It's cool when you get to share those experiences with those like-minded, excited people. Like sometimes you go on those trips and I mean the stars and planets align and you got these guys that I'm like, I have to pull the boat over. I'm like, I just want you to know this is special for even Alaska and us. Yeah. Like this is
right.
This, you guys are doubling up on 2-foot trout every run. This is not normal.
Right. Yeah. That's it. That's the expectations thing, right? To let people come up there, they probably are already thinking like, hey, I'm just going to catch a giant, you know, 2-foot trout every cast because it's Alaska, or I'm going to catch kings on every cast, right? But that's not really the way it works. Yeah. Well, and we had, you know, on our trip, and we talked about this, like I said, on the episodes with Adam, but I mean, we had some pretty epic stuff too, right? I mean, even though the water was high for us, I mean, that night where it cleared. Yeah. Remember that? The night where it cleared, we had the Northern Lights that popped out just like that. That was
super cool. Like that whole trip, like the water started off real tough. It was tough to even get that first trout. You know, you had to high stick it near the banks, you know, and it was just not easy. We had like 6 inches of visibility.
I know. That
I'm
was
surprised
crazy.
We caught anything that first day, but then the water dropped like, I would say almost a foot throughout that trip, and fishing just consistently got better, which is, you know, like Alaska, we don't have tailwaters, thank God. You know, everything's just wild. And, you know, you take what you get as whatever the Mother Nature wants to give you.
That's right. That's right. When do you guys think with the stuff with Fish Hound, when do you start? Because you're right now, we're kind of in the holiday Christmas stuff. When does that Fish Hound, when do you start getting stuff ready for that, for all that season?
For fly fishing, we start in... like mid late April when the rivers finally break up. And you know, as soon as the rivers break up and that ice is gone, you have a chance. And sometimes like that beginning season fishery, you could have a lights out day, or you could fish for like 3 days and not even feel or see anything. It's a really finicky fishery early season.
Yep.
And if you're not like, and if you're not fishing the right perfect spots, you're not getting anything. Very early season, you know, I made this mistake when I was younger. Cause you know, I used to just go to the Kenai with the buddies and stuff, and you're fishing the whole Kenai River is a big river in by itself. There's fish spread out through that river throughout the season. But when you come up north, it's a little bit of a learning curve there in the sense that these fish aren't living in the tributaries year round. They're going to the Big Stew. And so you got to concentrate your efforts on your time of year, depending on where these fish are. And, you know, like I remember fishing one of the tributaries in May, and I'm like, they ain't around. What the heck? There's nothing. And then it's like, oh, well, no shit. They're all at the bottom, you know? And it's just like, and as the water warms up and rises, you know, you're going to have your beginning season runoff. And right after that runoff, they're pretty much spread out for the most part in the river system. And, you'll find them that way.
Right. And does the Susitna just as, I guess the Susitna comes in right at Anchorage, pretty much at the Cook Inlet. And that's also Kenai. So it flows into like that whole area that it's all connected.
So the Kenai and the Susitna both flow into the Cook Inlet, but the Cook, so Anchorage, you would have to go across the Cook Inlet to see the Sioux. And some people, you know, they'll put in their boats and go duck hunting and stuff across the Sioux there at that Delta area or the estuary where the Sioux dumps in. But I want people to realize too, that Cook Inlet for the most part is like nasty mud, water. You know, it's not like ocean, like blue ocean. It's nasty, silty ocean water. Gotcha. Big tides come in and out, and all that river silt, you know, gets stirred up with those big tides. And like the Susitna is a big silty river. And the cool thing about the Susitna and like the Talkeetna, you know, is that it's silty in the summer, but it's clear in the winter. So if you have, because those glaciers, when it drops below freezing, they lock up and they're not dumping the silt anymore, but you still have a little bit of water, like your springs and whatnot, you know, making flowing water. And so as the season goes on and it starts to get clean again, cause right after breakup or when the ice is breaking up, it's pretty much dirty already. You know, it's silty water already, but as it drops and it gets cold in September, October, those rivers are totally fishable. And, you know, you could get lucky and find a spot. Now, the Susitna in my area, I think it's like 5 miles wide. It's a big braided river.
Wow. Yeah.
It's huge. I think it's in the top 10 rivers of North America.
Right. It's huge.
The thing is huge. There's so many different channels and stuff. And, you know, if you don't have a jet boat, you're not really fishing it. You can float from one tributary to another, but you're just, you know, I haven't done that yet. I would like to do that, you know, in the late fall, but usually we're too busy to do any like exploratory trip like that.
Yeah, I hear you. Okay, well, and let's wrap this up. Just we're going to take it out of here pretty quick, but as far as, again, that person coming up, they're doing their road, you know, traveling. So they got the Kenai, they can go down that area. We talked about the Susitna. Anything else you would tell somebody if they're kind of planning a trip? I mean, are there like some local fly shops where they can get some information? I mean, they can connect with you if they want to do a guide trip. What else do you tell somebody to get prepared to make sure they know kind of where they're going, what to do, what to bring?
So when you fly into Anchorage, my favorite fly shop in Alaska is Mossy's. Mike and Brian, the two guys that are always in there, they'll hook you up. They'll tell you where to go and how to do it. And they got all the gear that you need, whatever it is. And they're super friendly people. They're the ones that, you know, when I first started fly fishing, I would go in there with the stupid questions and all those things. And they treated me they treated me good. And like, they, you know, they still make fun of me today, to this day, when I got like, you know, with just stupid stories I come in there with. Like this one time I go down to the Kenai in the winter and I'm fishing the middle and I'm by myself and I just put a little Minn Kota on my single man pontoon and I'm floating the Skelak River into the mouth. And I had my two-handed rod and I thought it was a good idea. I could just troll my fly across the river as I'm switching sides.
Uh-huh.
Well, I got my fly line or my running line into my motor and I looked back and I watched my running line go all the way to my shooting head and just bink, there goes my shooting head.
Damn,
and I'm out
gone.
There with nothing. And I show up and they just see like a rat's nest on the end of my spool. And they still bring that up today.
That's and awesome. I'm like,
it was such a kook move I did, but whatever.
Yeah, right. Like, right. Did you have a backup rod, backup setup?
Not with me. It was back at the truck. Yep.
There you go.
Oh, that was a long, cold day. Freaking icebergs floating down past you. But
holy
like one
cow.
Thing I want to say on that road system is like it. Again, I keep saying time of year. But if you're going to come, some of the trout fishermen up here, the two trout bums, they love August, September because we call it football season up here because these trout look like footballs. You can have a skinny little tail on an 18-inch trout or 16. But it's the size of a Nerf ball. They're so fat and so strong. It's so fun. And if you want to go a little bit later into late September or mid-September to late September, beginning of October, now I'm trying to remember the laws, but you got Steelhead on the Kenai Peninsula.
Oh, wow.
Like your Anchor River, your Nanilchik, your Deep Creek, your Startsky Creek. Those all have Steelhead in there. And, you know, sometimes the river could be a teeny bit crowded in the more popular holes, but you can find spots where you're going to catch your silver or Steelhead. And there's also a bunch of silvers and Dolly Vardens in those rivers at that time, too. So you got options to even catch Steelhead on the road system. There is no Steelhead in the Susitna River Valley at all. You know, Steelhead start at the Kenai River down. There is some Steelhead in the Kenai River. They used to have a hatchery on the Kisilof River. And the Kisilof River is another big old river, slightly glacier-fed river.
Yeah.
And they used to have Steelhead hatchery there, and they took it out because they're afraid. Because the Kisilof and the Kenai, they come out into the ocean right next to each other. I forget the exact miles, but it's less than 20, and it's just you got all that water mixing back and forth in that area, so they're worried about hatchery Steelhead going into the Kenai, so they took that out. But there is some natural native runs of Steelhead in the Kenai. Now that could get a little confusing too, because when you got these rivers with big lakes on the system, you find yourself it could be a nice bright chromed out rainbow, like a knack-knack rainbow, you know. Those things are basically Steelhead. They're like, it's like a Great Lake Steelhead almost, you know. Your leopard bows are those bows that, you know, they're spotted and more dark. They're the ones that, you know, are more adapted to just be in the rivers, you know.
Right,
then you'll get
rivers,
your lake rainbows that are more brighter. And then you got like some of the rainbows that I find in the Susitna, like in the Susitna, in the dirty water itself that you sometimes catch in the trids themselves. They're like pale, you know, they're just a different look. And these fish are really good at adapting on how they should look in their given environment. And you could, it's when you catch this fish, you're like, oh, this fish is mainly from the Sioux, or this is a true leopard bow, or this guy's somewhere in between.
Cool. That's crazy.
It's different rainbows that you'll see up here.
Yeah, it's a different. And the cool thing about the rainbows is that they kind of evolved, right? That's where rainbows kind of started from. Like, if you go back in the evolutionary history, right? Alaska is the true first rainbow. I think that's kind of the story, right? Something like that.
You know, I never thought of it that way. I just know rainbows are native west of the Rockies, all the way from Mexico to Alaska or to Kamchatka, which is just wild to me that there used to be Steelhead in Baja.
I know. Isn't that nuts?
Oh, God. Like when you talked about the Rogue River earlier and then your grandpa just going 1930s and all I was thinking about, holy shit, I wish I could see that fishing back in the day.
Well, and that's the thing about that book is that it's so cool about reading that book is literally it's written about my great grandfather or it's my great uncle, I guess. But I mean, yeah, they're talking about fishing down there in the 1930s. And you know what I mean? Like it's imagine the difference, right? Because obviously there's been a lot more impacts and stuff over the years. So it's kind of crazy. I think we need to document, probably we need to do more documentation of like what you're doing as well, because it seems like maybe as scary as this sounds, like Chinook is showing us that it's not an unlimited supply of fish, right? I mean, you're seeing the effects now.
It's crazy. You know, here on this river used to have a super strong run of kings, and a lot of them are, you know, a bunch of them used to be in the 60 plus pound range to 80 sometimes, even on these little creeks here. And it's just sad because you got these guys that's been fishing it since the 80s up here and stuff, and you'll walk into an out of way hole where only locals know about, or you even need a key to get in a certain gate to get into this area, and you'll find people snagging kings on their spawning bed and stuff. And it just that's the only time, like on the river, is mishandling fish like the rainbows and stuff, or snagging kings that like it irks.
Yeah, no good.
Like you feel it in your bones. Like it's so hard. Yeah. And it's so hard to, you know, like you can't, everybody thinks it's their God-given will ability right up here to just you know, do whatever they want like they used to do it. And it's just wild. Like there on that helicopter trip, I heard a story one time back in the day when people were all kingfishing, like, and there used to be a lot of people fishing the bottom of that river kingfishing. And you keep the big kings on a stringer alive up to days until you catch a bigger king and you let that smaller king go. And it's just, and you're just, you know, you could be walking along a bank and all of a sudden those kings on a stringer come alive and thrashing around, ripping themselves up. And it's no, you know, sport fishermen have a small, you know, I don't know about small, but we do have a bigger take into fish populations than a lot of people. People just want to blame it on commercial or the hatchery pink and chum. Or the or the illegal overseas market. I think it starts with us too, of having better practices of catch and release and more ethical just targeting, and sometimes just leaving them alone, even if it's legal, because they're beautiful, gnarly, big ass fish, and their story is just so cool. And when you do hook one, it is just one of the most wild things. Like, you know, with these clients, sometimes like we're trout fishing, we have a 6 weight, you know, with 8 pound, 10 pound maxima, and they hook this king on a woolly bugger or a Dalai Lama. And it's like, well, what do I do now? I'm like, well, have fun for about a few seconds until that thing pops off. But you're not trying to reel this thing in, because we're just going to kill it trying to reel it in. So just,
We're going to pop it or let it go. Well, I love that take, because your take on that says a lot about, you know, your take is that, you know, like you said, all these things, it's the impacts are from everybody. And you said it well, a lot of people want to just point the fingers at somebody else instead of like actually looking back at themselves and be like, hey, you know, we're a part of this problem too. And you're saying it yourself, you know, the sport fishing industry and people involved are a part of the problem. It's like, you know, I think you're hitting on it. It's like, we got to work together. That's how you solve these problems, is working together as opposed to pointing fingers, right?
Yes. And when it comes to Alaska, there's like no barbless laws I've seen up here yet. You know, and that's one thing as a company, you know, especially with some of our newer guides, I'm a big stickler about he's like, well, what about if we're killing salmon? You know, I'm like, well, how many trout do you catch on that Dalai
Exactly.
Lama? You know, no, we're debarbing all these hooks.
Exactly. And think about the hooking. And I remember this the first time I did the Skeena steelhead, you know, because that was the first time we really went hard on barbless, because you had to. And I'll tell you what, we caught just as many fish.
Exactly. Like
you can hook and land fish on a barbless fly. It's totally the same. I mean, you're lost. It's, you know, so people, they're stuck on it, right? They're people stuck on that barb actually helps.
A perfect example. I'm on the one of the rivers on the Kodiak, and it's my first time fishing it in July. Usually we're there for a steelhead later on in October. Mm. And Dave, this last October trip, oh my God. I don't know if you talked to Adam about that at all, but.
Oh yeah. Was this where you guys hooked like 100 fish or something?
Oof. It was a lot of fish. Like there was days where we had between six people over 50 fish. You know, that wow. It was.
So 50 fish. So you're these are steelhead. So you're swinging dry line steelhead.
Yep. Or you could swing it.
Sinking.
It's a shallow river. So it's an intermediate line or light.
Yeah.
And
type three, something light. Yeah.
There's times where, you know, I'm wading across the river and I'm carrying rods and I'm like, screw it. I'll just let this one swing fly. Just hang out down river while I wade. Just wade across. I'm just walking across with the fly in the water and you hook a fish and you're like, holy shit, now what? And it's like, it was just the most wild fishing. And to start that trip off to your fishing some of the smaller tributaries off the lake and haven't seen any steelhead there, some decent rainbows and a lot of dollies. And you're fishing feet, I mean, literally feet away from giant Kodiak brown bears. And it's just,
oh wow,
super wild experience. And sometimes, oh really?
So you're sitting there fishing, they're just hanging, the brown bears are like right next to you there, you're just hanging with them?
Right next to us while we're fishing. They're chasing salmon around. And sometimes when they're chasing the salmon, they don't see you. And you're like, oh, this thing is going to run right into us and he's going to get spooked. And so you try to just make yourself known a little bit. If you can move out of the way, you move out of the way. But sometimes you got a bunch of alders and brush where you can't move out of the way.
So sometimes you're sticking there. The brown bears see you and there, or the Kodiak bears see you and they just kind of walk right by you.
Yeah, they're just like, you know, they just mosey on by you usually. Sometimes they'll get, they'll be like, no, I want that section of the beach. And depending on the vibe or anything on that bear, you're going to stay there and tell that bear you're not, no, I'm not leaving here. Or you just move out of the way and watch the bear do its thing. Like I was with two older gentlemen from New Jersey and we're kind of by ourselves away from the main group. And I'm sitting there retying a hook or doing something. And I look up or I hear something in the brush 5 feet away from me, two cubs. Freaking, we spooked each other. Like I could reach out and touch it damn near. And then the mama bear just stands up right behind them. And I'm like, oh fuck, you know, damn. That's what, you know, I'm pretty comfortable around bears, but yeah, I did have my hand on my gun right then. Hey mama, you're good, mama. You're good. And then they backed away. She did. It was crazy watching her do, like, I didn't even hear anything, but the two cubs knew exactly what she was saying. They went off, then she went off. It was so cool. And there was a bunch of little experiences like that. Super wild fun.
God, that's Kodiak. That's Kodiak. Yeah, we've talked a little bit about that with Adam, that, yeah, you guys run that operation there. And I hope to dig more into that as well. So cool. Well, I think I'll leave it there and maybe just give you a shout out. So we'll, fishhoundexpeditions.com. They can track you down there or any of the crew, and we'll put your, put a link into some other stuff there on maybe your email, just so people can, if they have a direct question, but yeah, anything else you want to give a shout out to, or I guess, you know, in the next, after the new year, like, right. What do you have coming here the next 6 months? You get, you got some winter stuff going or just hanging low?
Right now I'm helping doing the snowcat gig operation, you know, where we they're at Willow Creek Resort where we put in that first day. They run snowcats across the Sioux for like different lodges and stuff, hauling in whatever material that they need. So I'll be driving snowcats this year.
Oh nice.
And at some point I need to go down to the States or Hawaii and do some fishing and visiting family. And I don't know when that's going to happen, but that's basically my winter right now.
There you go.
Just praying it stays above zero because it's freaking cold.
Yeah. 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 It is. Cool. All right. Well, hey, just want to thank you for, you know what I mean, all the time today and then putting together that trip because, you know, when we did it, that first day we had that little bonus day, we went out with you and it was just a great way to start the trip. You know, I think I might've got my biggest fish on that trip on Willow that day. And then it was just a great start. And, but yeah, I appreciate, you know, all the good stuff, man.
Yeah. Willow was fishing good.
Is it? Yeah.
It was like, well, not right now. It's frozen.
But... Not right now. Yeah.
But yeah, it was fun hanging out with you and Torres and my dog. That was a good day.
That's right. That's right. And the dog. Yeah. And you got your dog. Cool, man.
Steelhead song and everything.
That's right. Yeah. I got to relook at it. Well, Cam's got some pics. Well, from our Pelly stuff, Cam's got some pics. We had some pics from that too. That's right. The Steelhead song and the shotgunning and all that stuff. It was a good trip. Right on, man. All right, Phil. Well, I'll check back with you when we get this ready to roll. Thanks for all your time and we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, Dave. Thanks. And it was a pleasure fishing and talking to you today.
So there we go. Wetflyswing.com/401. 401. We've moved across the finish line and we're at the starting point again, getting ready to launch into that next race. 100 more episodes to go into that next finish line. 500. Where is it going to take us? I want to take a look ahead at what we have coming up on this podcast. But first, let's give a quick listener shout out. John Uher from Colorado loves to target cruising brown trout in clear water. He's on our newsletter list, and he replied back during that giveaway we had this year up to Alaska. Cheers, John. Thanks for checking out and replying back on that email. Check in with me anytime if you get a chance and want me to put together some podcast episodes for you. Okay, where are we headed? Let's take a quick peek. Doo-doo. All right, so here we go. So, looks like tomorrow, actually, we are going right back at it tomorrow. We got Maine fly fishing. We got Kevin McKay coming on to dig into brook trout. This is a good one. He digs into some of the big brook trout up there in Maine, up there in that corner. That's a good one. Next week, looks like pretty excited. Looks like we have a good diverse selection next week. We got Kinsley with a steelhead episode. We got an interesting one with a skateboarder, pro skateboarder slash fly fisherman. And we're also launching the littoral zone or the littoral zone. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce that, but let's just call it littoral zone. And this is where Phil Roy is going to be coming on here and actually giving us some cool advice directly from him. So we're going to let Phil take the mic and get ready for that. I'm pretty excited about these new series we're doing. We're actually going to have Phil and some of the other best out there come on this podcast, take the mic. It's like the mic, it's not the mic drop, it's the mic handover. And I'm going to let Phil work his magic, and we're going to post that next week. So stay tuned for that. Okay, I guess that's about it. Gives you a little update on next week. We're doing a lot of content here, so it's a lot of fun to share what we have coming. Again, I mentioned before, you can reach out to me, Dave, at wetflyswing.com anytime. I want to thank Will, Adam, Cam, and the whole crew at Fishhound for helping to put together this amazing trip this summer. Nick and I had a great time, and we are hoping to do this again. If you haven't connected with Fishhound, give them a shot right now, fishhoundexpeditions.com. Best thing to do is to click there. Click that. There's a link there on that website. Send Adam an email. Give him a call. Let him know you're interested in Alaska if you want to connect with Will or any of the crew. All right, I'm going to get out of here. Hope you are having a good afternoon, good evening, or good morning, wherever you are in the world, even if you are on the other end of the planet. And if you are, if you're in one of those 100 countries or so that we are, we have listeners in, and you're far away from the United States, I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to hear from the person who's the furthest away from the Oregon area of the United States. So check that out. Throw out the map, throw in Portland, Oregon, and then throw in your destination and send me a mileage report. How many miles are you? Send me a message. I'd love to get this on social. Maybe you could ping me on Instagram, DM, or give us a mention there and say, hey, we are 10,000 miles. I don't even know. How far is it around the planet? Or at least halfway around the planet. How many miles is it? How far do you have to go? All right, this is a new game we're going to have here. And I will probably try to announce the winner if I hear back from a few people. Thanks again. I hope you're having a good day and looking forward to catching up with you online or on the water.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.